Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. For those of you of a certain age and who grew up in a certain geographical location, that is the sound of Formula One, ladies and gentlemen. That is the theme tune to the BBC, the BBC's Grand Prix TV show. It is, of course, Fleetwood Mac and The Chain, or at least the good bit at the end. And I thought I'd choose this because, you know, it's a special Formula One themed edition of the show. Ron Howard's Rush in cinemas at the moment, and this is also a rare special occasion in that our main film for the day is one that we've all seen.
So, we got there in the end.
We did.
Yeah.
So lots to talk about. Also in actually, why don't we introduce the our people around the table? You know, I know that regular listeners will know who's here.
They all know us.
Yeah, but there's new listeners every
week.
You're
talking to me. No, they know us. Don't you?
Yeah. Well, for new people, I'm Kaylee.
Sai doesn't like saying Sai's name.
Sai. It's me.
That's S-I-G-H.
All right.
With a capital F.
That's what I hear all the time, Kaylee.
What, when people look at you, you're adoring fans.
Yeah, that's right.
Fainting.
This is season 4, episode 24 of Cinematica. And in today's episode, driving around in circles in Rush, we're going to find out what's behind the locked door in The Best Offer. And we're going to ask what the flip is going on in Mood Indigo. We also interview the director of the Italian Film Festival, which opens in Auckland tonight. So Tony Lambert joins us later in the show. But first, shall we find out what's in the mailbag? What have people been tweeting us?
Yes, so we have quite a few Rush reviews and a couple One Direction tour reviews as well. So Miriam Ross says, One Direction 3D, no direction. Ooh. And her tour review for Rush is nail-biting. Rudy Six, one of our biggest fans, and also, we learned this week, a huge Formula One fan.
Yep.
Ah. Good work.
He says, two-word review for Rush is educational excitement. I love it, but I think there's a big slip in one part, but I need to confirm.
And he did.
I think he did.
He suggested that there is a fault in some of the art direction.
Yes, because the abbreviation they use for Austria in one of the... They show that the point summary is AUS, but that's Australia. It should be AUT for Austria, where Niki Lauda is from. But I watched a couple races from that era, and they didn't actually, the ones I've viewed, they didn't put
the country
that the driver's from. They didn't have room with their giant teletype text thing on screen.
Right, so, but you'd still have to say that the art department or the graphics department fell down there. But it's possibly one of the few areas of the film that isn't.
Unless that abbreviation has changed in the last 30, 40 years, but I don't think so.
No.
I think that's been set for some time.
So how far back are you going with the tweets? Because I'm scrolling back here and...
There's lots.
There's lots, eh? People have been just firing them at
Getting
us.
Busy. Good work.
Yep. And Blanca Nieves, we got told off. We got schooled.
Did you? I want to hear that.
We got told off by David Larson, Leif Lemming on Twitter for spoilers.
Yeah,
when we talked about Blanca Nieves last week. So I want to apologise for that.
Hold on, what did we say? I can't even remember.
The whole movie.
Did we?
Yeah, that's how we reviewed it, because I just kept going on about how much I loved it, and I just told the whole story. Sorry. Yeah.
So, okay, we're going to concentrate.
I mean, there were going to be dwarves in it, surely.
So, this week I've been given Rush. I can't spoil that, really.
No,
that's right.
I mean, unless you don't know the story, and if you don't know the story, I don't know if you'd be... You may not be interested in the film, but it is a great film. But anyway, we'll get to that later.
My favorite part of that conversation was where we came up with a new tagline for the show, which is overexcited fan yammering.
Yeah,
which is, you know, pretty much what we do every Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
And David Larson also tweeted, he's praying that Elysium is the only time Blomkamp tries writing a film solo, because there's a conversation between him and Barnaby HM about.
About the relative merits of Elysium and Matt Damon and overcookedness thereof.
Yes, yes.
So, look, this is the great thing. If you follow us on Twitter, you get to take part in conversations with all sorts of other film fans simultaneously, and you get to contribute to the show. So if you are thinking of, if you're not on Twitter and you're thinking of joining.
Just for us.
Yeah, just for us, and make sure, you know, we're your first follow. And of course, we also pay some attention to the contributions that people make to our Facebook page. We're always looking for tips and news that we can share with other people. So, you know, make sure that you're friends with us on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can email us news and stuff like that that we can share as well. So that is what you've been saying. What have you been watching? Have you got our top five in front of you, Kenny?
I do. And aside from number five, everything's new this week. Very exciting.
Well, it was eight. There were eight films opened last weekend. I looked at it because I was trying to plan my weekend, and I thought, you know, I was nine films behind on my written reviews, the ones that I put on the website.
Just
and I thought I was going to be able to do some catching up. I couldn't do it. Eight films.
What's up with that, eh?
It's mad. Yeah. Mm.
All right, so in number five, down from the number one position, that's a big drop, is Riddick. In four, One Direction, This Is Us. Number three is Rush. Number two, Percy Jackson, Sea of Monsters. And number one, The Smurfs 2. Now, those two films we will be reviewing next week as part of a school holiday special.
Yeah, we're going to cover off the whole school holiday thing, which is going to include One Direction.
Who's going to watch that?
I have already.
Oh,
I've
good work.
Done that one. Yeah,
well, that's right. I've got that photo. Did you get that photo, Kaylee?
I saw it.
Yep.
Yeah, you're going to post that bad boy?
I'm auditioning to be...
He blends right in.
He does. Yeah. A bit taller than the others, but...
Yeah, well, that's right.
You're British, so you make it.
Yeah, true, yeah. Exactly, and you know, working class, and so we'll do the One Direction, Percy Jackson, The Smurfs, which I haven't seen yet, and of course Planes and Turbo open this Thursday. So we're going to spend the weekend surrounded by children, aren't we?
Yeah, but I want that Turbo Man.
I know.
Struck into my heart.
We saw that bad boy. In
exactly. So just in case you're wondering, quite at some of the major cinemas around the country, there are giant
snails.
Ride on. You could sit on them.
No,
they're cordoned off. I encourage everyone to ride on. Try it.
I want to know how those got shipped to the cinema. Was it just in a crate?
That would have been in a crate, yeah. Or maybe they...
Because you usually get those flat pack standees.
I can't imagine them.
But you can't.
Those flat packs can be quite hard to make up, let alone a bloody plastic...
Light up snail.
Yeah, like, no.
Actually, that is one of the funniest things. When you go to Reddings in Wellington on a Thursday, they assemble those cardboard standees in front of everybody. So, you know, it's not like they go off into a back room, build them, and then bring them out. No, they have to. It's like building IKEA in front of your flatmates. It must be just the most embarrassing thing in the world.
Because they're so big, that's the easiest place to do it.
I know. But
there's pressure.
Exactly.
People walking past.
Exactly.
Oh, I think you got the Mr. Son. Yeah, no.
You missed a bit.
Yeah, got it. Yeah.
What's this? Where does this bit slot in? Yeah. Oh, look, fun and games. So where do we get to?
What's happening? What
Smurfs is number one.
Smurfs 2 is number one.
Smurfs
outside school halls. That's all right, isn't it?
That's pretty good.
That's a sign of it. Yeah, that's a big weekend, isn't it?
To a franchise from the 80s.
Smurfalicious, isn't it?
Smurftastic. Oh yeah. Anyway, so those of you who have kids and you're wanting to choose, you know, because most families can only really afford to do one film a week, right, during school holiday. So you're going to have to make
depends if it's raining.
Three
days in a row, you're out every day. Movies, let's go.
So we will be providing our grown-up verdict on the school holidays.
I'm looking forward to Turbo.
You are, aren't you? You're excited.
I'm up for that. I am excited about that. Yeah, I don't know why, but I am.
Yeah, it's also, but it's already one of the most notorious flops of the year.
I know. Well, is it? What about
box
Planes?
Office wise?
What about Planes?
Well, I don't know if Planes has actually had the same kind of level of expectation or money behind it. So you know, it's quite often the definition of flop is like where you thought it was going, not necessarily. I mean, Planes looks like a straight to video movie that they've just chucked to the movie screen, doesn't it? It looks like one of those sequels that ends up filling out the box set.
The other thing about Turbo,
we'll see.
Does Turbo occur in the world of Formula One? Open wheeler, is it, or more like?
It'll be NASCAR.
Yeah, it's pretty hard though. After you've seen Rush, to you know, get excited about snails, fast snail on the track.
Still, but you know, there'll be fake representations of current racing stars.
Yes,
that'll
yes.
be fun. That's what I'm going to go for. Okay. The comedy.
Do you think there'll be "Walk with Me, Wiki Bobby"?
What?
Do you think that'll be in there? "Walk with Me, Wiki Bobby."
That's Talladega Nights, isn't it? Oh my goodness!
It's the Frenchman.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are appreciate you get a chance to appreciate the full range of size talents today.
I've got it all. I reckon he's brilliant in that film. Not the rest of it's kind of inane, but Sacha Baron Cohen in it. He's indeed great.
I love when he has to drive with a cougar in the car. That was great.
Yeah, that was great.
Now, I'm being slightly distracted by shiny things being waved around in front of me. You've got a toy golem there with a ring.
That's my wedding ring, by the way, golem. I want it back.
It hasn't made him invisible, so it's obviously not the magic one. And what else have you got there that's just arrived?
And I've got my gravity spaceman suit squeezy. I wish I could give you a sound, people, but I can't.
It doesn't squeak.
It's just there for stress relief. And it's really, really good. It's great.
It's an astronaut with the words gravity
on his backpack.
Screened onto the backpack.
Big old American flag on his arm.
And it's like, oh no, I'm doing a scene from the movie.
Is it?
I'm in space.
I think you throw it out the window and then it's a theme scene from the movie.
And he's going spinning around trying to grab things.
Is it Clooney or Bullock?
Bullock is the one who's spinning out in space.
Just tried to grab onto your laptop. No, I missed.
That's what happens when you go into space with your arms actually sealed to your sides.
To your side, yeah. You can't move them.
And gloves that don't. Yeah. So, anyways, this
will be good. This will gravity be really, theory. Really good.
Yeah, opens much. October 3rd.
Mm. And this, ladies and gentlemen, gives you a little insight into the world of cinema exhibition and promo. Mm. These are the kind of toys that get sent to cinemas to help get. A film from 3 sessions a day to 4 sessions a day, isn't it? You're basically...
I don't know about that. I mean, that's a little, you know, rubby squeezy thing. I mean, come on.
Oh, look, it's all goodwill.
I need a pot of gold. I need a crate of wine, if anyone's listening. You know, something like that.
Well, you know, I know that you're pretty much... You're pretty impossible to persuade, but you know, these little things, they mount up over time, and you know, there's a collectible. It'll be on eBay soon enough.
Not by me.
No. Good
put
stuff.
This one. This one's going in the pool room.
All right. Time to get on to some movies, actually, I think, probably. Do you think?
I think so.
There's a lie that all drivers tell themselves. Death is something that happens to other people.
What kind of person does a job like this? Each year, 2 of us die.
James can be a loose cannon.
Nick is a genius setting up the cars.
I accept every time I get in my car, there's 20% chance I could die.
Being driven around 170 miles per hour, this thing's a bomb on wheels.
I'm quicker than all of you.
And let's race.
Back in the days when Formula One was exciting.
It still is.
Oh,
Not compared to that. That's too. It's... I think it's become, just too cold and sterile compared to that, hasn't it? Jeez.
Yeah, well, the excitement comes from the off the racetrack drama, sometimes on the racetrack.
In the courtrooms.
Yeah.
Like the gossip and the...
I want to see them having a swig of wine before they jump in their cars and all that sort of thing, smoking a bit of weed.
The cigars.
Yeah.
So, okay, Kaylee, you're our Formula One expert.
Yep.
You're going to put us straight about how accurate...
that's a big call, isn't it?
Yep.
And does it matter?
Does it matter that it matters?
That's
does
right.
it need to matter?
That's right.
Does it need to matter? Well, it's a Ron Howard film, so we all knew. I mean, we should all know if we've watched Ron Howard films going into it. There will always be that very intense bromance element of two people coming together and like finding strength in each other. That was going to happen. We saw that coming in the trailer.
Mm.
You know, I don't know how accurate it is to their real lives because I'm not familiar with that. What are you guys doing?
Sorry, I was just having a few headphones issues. Sorry.
Yeah, it's like at a rock concert when you bring out the broken guitar. You know,
string. Yeah, need it. Yeah, where's my roadie?
That's right.
Right. So
I was listening.
Mm.
So make up for lost time. Rush is the retelling of the story of Formula One racers Niki Lauda and James Hunt, two very different drivers. James Hunt was a playboy, loved being famous, loved sleeping with lots of women, some of whom who get storylines and others don't. They just sort of drop off out of the movie. Whereas Niki was very precise. He built up the cars. He knew about the technology and really dedicated.
He was professional, wasn't he?
Very professional, very dedicated. Went home early, got married in a very, very bland civil union. Two very, very different people who, in one of their races, was most famous for crashing in a very, or sorry, Niki Lauda crashed his car in a very fiery, fiery, flamey, horrible way. Got really horrible burns to his body, but ended up returning to the track because he couldn't bear to sit there in the hospital and watch James Hunt win his points towards the championship.
It was one of the most remarkable sporting stories of the 1970s, really. You know, the fact that, you know, he could easily, nobody would have batted an eyelid if he'd said, look, you know what, I'm out for this for this season. You know, he'd already won the world championship twice. You know, like, he didn't have anything to prove, you'd think. He could have taken the rest of the year off, got himself fully well, and then charged into it fresh the next year. But there was something about Hunt, and Hunt in particular, like, if anybody else, I reckon, in that mob had looked like they were going to win the world championship, it wouldn't have been such a big deal for him. But there was something about Hunt that really got up his nose.
Well, it's because he didn't work for it.
Yeah.
Or he didn't come across.
He didn't take it seriously.
He didn't take it seriously. Yeah. And he was there to have a good time as well as try and win, wasn't he?
Mm.
It seemed, anyway. I mean,
yeah. And their rivalry started earlier when they were racing in Formula 3. Mm. And so they very quickly set up this sort of relationship between the two. Call each other assholes and flip each other the bird all the time.
I mean, I actually found it, you know, like, really interesting, the fact that he had this amazing driver. You know, he was a real playboy and charismatic and a real pinup, you can imagine, for the sport. And you have Lauda there, who's kind of really just, it's business, and everything about it is business and science and cold-hearted decisions. There's no sort of, you know, passion or excitement about it.
He was constantly measuring the risk as well.
Yeah, and I thought that was really, you know, that was kind of, you know, and to have those two forces kind of working all the time. And I can see why there was that sense of competition, because, you know, Lauda had left his family, left his wealth, done all these things to take this opportunity and really had to really work for it. And there's a couple of scenes in there where, you know, like, where he gets taken on, I think, is it Ferrari take him on?
Mm-hmm.
And he is meant to be just
love that scene.
Yeah, but he's just meant to be a backup man, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he goes in there and he goes, right, well, let's look at the car, starts working on the car, comes up with all these options or solutions, works with the mechanics night and day, does all this sort of stuff and says, right, it's going to be so many seconds faster when it goes around the track. And they go, rubbish. And he goes, well, you give me a car. Well, you basically, you know, gets his car, I think, or whatever, as a result.
He certainly makes sure that he's
not... before he goes to Ferrari.
Yeah, but it was in that lead-in, too, getting into Ferrari, wasn't it?
That's how he gets into Ferrari, was designing that car.
And sure enough, it goes around the track, and it does exactly what he says. And yet, Hunt, you never see him working.
He barely practiced.
He didn't have that relationship on the technical side, I thought. You know, he was there to race, and you give me a good car and I'll win, but you've got to give me a good car. And I thought that was really interesting, you know, like the work ethics between the two.
And the team ethics as well. And that, I mean, you could tell that Lauda's ego meant that he absolutely wanted to win, but he knew that he was only going to be able to do that with the help of the talented people around him, you know. So there was, you know, he was urging the everybody to be their best, whereas Hunt was just about, I'm just going to let you do what you do because I don't really understand it.
Mm.
Now, just if we could move on to the storytelling part of it, because it spends quite a long time setting up the world, doesn't it? You know, there's a lot of the build up, that Formula 3 history, the introducing the characters, and I kind of felt that it didn't really hit its stride as a drama until we get to Formula 1, and in fact until the accident, really, and that's when it really becomes quite gripping, that those races up to the accident and afterwards, you know, in the rain in Tokyo, in Japan, there was just some of the best motor racing recreations on film that I've ever seen. It really was gripping. But it just felt like the second half was much stronger than the first.
Yeah, and with that that race, they really did save the best for last. Like, there's this slow motion and there's all this setup and these close-ups, whereas the rest of the film, they're just sort of trying to get in all this information for people who don't know the backstory and don't know the history, which is good for non-Formula One fans if they're going to see a movie about a drama, if they like Chris Hemsworth, or if they just like cars in general. It gives you all the information you need. I found the voiceover really clunky. Mm. I don't like voiceovers. And because they had... I think they shared the story between Lauda and Hunt quite well, but a lot of it was in voiceover to explain what was going on and to forward the plot a lot faster.
But you see, I'm someone who's never followed Formula One, and I found that really... I mean, I didn't mind that at all. It was helpful, and I didn't mind the fact that it didn't feel to me like it was taking too long to get to where it was going, and it was building all the time. So, I you know, I mean, in a way, that for me ticks the boxes of you know, like keeping you interested and keeping it moving.
So as somebody who didn't follow Formula One, how much of the story did you know before you went in? So did you know
Niki Lauda had a crash and was badly burned? Right. That was about
but you didn't know how fast he came back.
Didn't know how fast he came back. I didn't know anything about the rivalry. Right. It was all quite you know.
And it worked. And that worked for you.
Yeah, it really did. It was really new to me, and I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the fact that you it's a sort of discovery, and the actors are very, very good.
Yeah, I've got a big two thumbs up for Chris Hemsworth, who is better known as Thor, probably first introduced to cinema screens as Kirk's dad in the first of the new Star Trek movies. He's only on screen for about a minute.
All right.
Exploded in yet another fiery ball of flame. Yep. But Chris Hemsworth, you know, of the three Hemsworth brothers, and I say this having not seen any of the third Hemsworth brother, but I'm just going to assume that they work their way down the batting order. He's all right, and he certainly gets Hunt's accent, you know, which is so as an impersonation it works. But also... he has a very different physicality to what we're used to seeing him as Thor, and I think that's he's obviously he can put that bulk up and take it off reasonably well, but I think the standout performer is Daniel Brühl as Lauda, who's it's a difficult part to pull off because it could so easily have been a caricature. He could so easily have just been a kind of a negative a hero and a villain.
And at certain times of the film, you have real sympathy for him.
Yeah.
You know, not just in the when he gets badly burnt, but prior to that, you know, and all the sort of blows he takes, but then this complete determination. Mm. And
it balances the two of them really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, because unlike Senna, where it was very one-sided and you didn't get Prost's story at all, I never felt like Lauda was ever a bad guy. Mm. It's like, you know, you got his story and sort of figure out who he was. But Daniel Brühl's incredible performance. Mm. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and you know, the way that it's shot and the scenes about, you know, over the vehicles and so on, you know, when they're starting up and all that, it's brilliant. The way that it kind of gets that, you can smell the sort of fuel. You can smell, you know, the sense of sweat and hard work and all that sort of thing that comes into it. I think it's really presented really well in that respect.
And the digital, presumably mostly digital recreations of the period, you know, are just fantastically well done. I've never ceased to be surprised by how effective digital recreations of real situations are. You know, not I'm getting tired of, as we've talked about on the show before, you know, planets exploding and what have you, but you know, the technology being put into service of actually making history more vivid, I think is really effective. So I think we should try and sum up.
Well, just the way that they wrap the film up too, I think is really, really well done.
True.
Because it was kind of, I was sitting there a little bit going, I wonder how they're going to, you know, knock this off because the races are concluded and so on. But the way that they end the film, I thought was really good. And I had to go with Hunt
and
on
respectful.
That. Yeah, and very respectful. But I had to go with Hunt on, you know, it was funny because at different parts of the film, you know, I was really thinking, you know, Niki Lauda's character is, you know, he's got this great work ethic, determination, you know, all these things that are good in terms of, you know, getting ahead. You know, he's determined and yet Hunt's kind of this playboy who kind of works hard in patches but likes to have fun and all the rest of it. So, but then at the end, you know, all of a sudden I sort of felt myself thinking, no, he's right. He's absolutely right. You know, you take, if you get too clinical, if you get too sort of sterile about this, you just take the fun out of it and you take all the excitement and passion and that's what it's all about. It has to be about that. But I reckon that's what racing is now. It's more technical.
It's more louder than
Hunt. It's more louder than Hunt.
Would you say? We both of us stare at the Formula One fan in the room.
I think it still depends on the driver. I think you still have these sort of glamorous drivers who just show up and they race and they're there for testing and they win world championships, but you know, some are more involved than others. And but it's still, I mean, Formula One, the reason I sort of enjoy it is it's a very wealthy sport. So it's very glamorous. There's a lot of gossip and it's just sort of fluffy, you know? It's like the racing is exciting and intriguing, and I have this whole like fantasy team, so I have to pay attention for that. But it is one of those very posh, very, very posh sports.
A bit like yacht racing.
Yeah. A bit like yacht racing, yeah.
Yeah. Did anybody know if any cinemas are going to open up at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning for the big race?
We've watched it a couple of times here.
Yeah. Mm. On the big screen?
Just private screenings.
Right. Yeah. Mm. I wonder if you could sell a ticket or two to something that's actually free to air.
Oh no, you wouldn't do that.
No, there's contracts involved.
No, you wouldn't do that. Yeah, also that's not right.
It's free to air. That sounds like somebody's actually investigated this and has and has definitive answer to it. Anyway, before we close, let's get two words for Rush.
My two words for Rush are speedy bromance.
Good, good, good. While Simon's thinking of his, I'll tell you a wee story. Remember we played the Grand Prix theme music at the beginning of the show all those minutes ago? In those days, the commentator on the BBC was Murray Walker, who was just the voice of motor racing for a long time. And for me, watching the film, it got more exciting the moment somebody with Murray Walker's voice started commentating on it. And I remembered a joke from when I was a kid about that somebody said, there goes Nicky, louder. There goes Nicky, even louder. So that's my two words, even louder.
Even louder. And I just want to say that I think that this is, if you're into Formula One, that's great, but this isn't a film for car racing fans. It's a film for everyone, and it has a lot of really good messages that come out of it. And so I don't think people should be put off by it in any way, because it's just purely about, you know, it's not about Formula One. It's a lot of more things, bigger things than that.
Yes, and if anyone's interested in watching races from those times, there are quite a few on YouTube. Mm. So
I'm just going to say that this is an F1 surprise, because it was for me.
Excellent.
Hello, who's speaking?
Claire Ibbotson. To be honest, I haven't decided yet, but I would like to have a, what's the word?
Valuation. And Miss Claire, what else can you tell me about her?
Suffers from a very strange illness.
He speaks to her, but through a closed door.
A closed door? What, you mean he's never seen her face?
Not only him, no one has. It's a fake.
From Rush to Jeffrey Rush, best offer.
The best offer.
Si, you're our antiques and collectibles and art
I do expert. Like Antique Roadshow, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
How much? How much? You're joking. Yeah, no, I don't know what to say after that. This is from the director of Cinema Paradiso.
Yeah,
and
so big shoes to fill.
It's got big shoes to fill, and it's got a great cast, and a cast that can stand up and be counted. Jeffrey Rush is very good in this role, and it really is this. He is this introverted, very serious sort of art auctioneer who has his own private collection, and often with his friend, played by Donald Sutherland, kind of gets him involved in bids and purchases these paintings.
He's a bit dodgy, isn't he?
It's a little bit shifty what they're doing, and they've been doing it for years, and they've got this kind of thing, this mateship going on. And it's interesting because, Rush's character, he wears gloves all the time. Even when he goes out to eat, he doesn't take his gloves off except to touch art,
it's like he feels the vibe of the art through it, doesn't it? It's like he takes the glove off and he can tell whether something's legitimate or illegitimate.
That's like the one thing you're not supposed to touch with gloves off.
Yeah, true. But I almost think it's like, that's when he gets paid to do his work, and that's when he brings out the magic, and if you want to. If you want the magic, you got to pay for it. It's almost like that in a way.
There is a bit of that, and because he's also a bit of a germ phobic as well, and so he wraps a telephone in a handkerchief before he'll answer it and stuff like that. So you get the feeling that he's got some intriguing psychological flaws to him.
He has, and he's very and he's lonely. He's very isolated and doesn't really have any friends, and it's just him and his art world, and yet he's got this amazing room just full of images of women, and that's all it is. No other forms of art in there whatsoever. And And that's how kind of the film opens. And along the way, there's a sort of a rather, strange or a customer gets in touch with him who he cannot see, who resides behind the wall, hidden away, but she can talk to him through this wall, and she wants to sell up. She's the daughter of this family that's just got this house full of, antiques.
All the stuff that gets him going,
yeah,
basically.
That's right. Yeah, it's just a massive turn on for him and all this amazing art. And there's the... clock type, was it metronome or
the automaton?
Automaton, yeah. And there's an automaton, which is what he studied. He did his PhD in and things like that. And so, and she's there, and she's actually hidden away in it. And it really intrigues him. It really gets to him, and he becomes this kind of driving thing for him to find out. Who is this woman? I want to see her. And
what's the mystery? He's determined to unravel the mystery, and in turn, unravel himself a wee bit.
Yep. And so he has this friend who starts working on this piece of equipment for him, and it's funny because as they keep removing more and more, and they go through these very, I must say that this is, it happens a lot where he's doing some work and she has a tantrum and tells him to go away and not to come back, and then a week later or 2 days later she's on the phone in tears saying, "I'm so sorry, come back," sort of thing. And it happens a lot in the film. It sort of ebbs and flows like that. Yeah. And it is a bit over, it's overdone and it gets a bit sort of tiresome. But because you can see that there's something building here and it's going to happen soon and so on, but it takes its time to get there.
I found this is a really tricky film to talk about plot wise because even if you say there's a twist, you're sort of even that knowledge is a kind of spoiler in itself because
it
then people are sitting waiting
for the
twist.
If you're watching it, you can see it coming.
Well, I think
don't you reckon?
I saw something coming. I don't know if I saw the extent of it or the detail of it, and so there was still some pleasure to be had. I knew something was up and I knew what the clues were, but actually it gets put together in quite an elegant way.
It does get put together in the end. It does get put together really nicely, but it takes its time to get there. And also for me, you knew that something like that was going to happen. It maybe not in the exact way that it pans out, but pretty much big picture, that he's getting played. And that's what happens. But his response to that is quite interesting as well.
Yeah.
So it's not, there are some surprises in there, and it is interesting. But it is something that is quite laborious. It takes its time, and it goes back two steps, goes forward one. It does sort of feel like that to me. Yeah.
Giuseppe Tornatore, the filmmaker, we mentioned Cinema Paradiso earlier on in the show, and this is the filmmaking history that he comes from, the classical. This is not one of those films where the camera's on, moving around all the time, that shaky cam. There's not lots of fast cutting. It's very elegant. The moves that the camera makes are very precise and very smooth, and the compositions are very elegant and very respectful of the kind of art world that we're talking about in the film. And so I get the feeling that, yes, it doesn't move very fast, but for some audiences, this is going to be like a trip back in time to the way that films used to be made, in that the story will just take its own time and the images are beautiful and the costumes are fantastic. And what I want to say here is that Ennio Morricone, his music, I think it's one of the best scores that I've heard all year or in a long time.
Yep.
And Morricone is fantastic and he's put to absolutely brilliant use.
Yeah, it is a film, though, that you think, if it had just been maybe cut a bit differently or if it had been handled, it could have actually been a lot tighter and a lot more sort of edgy a seat, because it's definitely not edgy. There are times when you feel like, come on, because it addresses the same issue over and over again, I think, too much.
True.
So it is a shame, because I think that it's probably something, underneath that that's even better. Yeah. And that's probably the disappointment for me.
Right.
But I thought, Jeffrey Grush is great. And you're right, it is a very classical looking film. And I guess maybe that's why it is paced that way. And for me, I still found it, a good watch. But
I think there's some satisfaction there to be had for most audiences. I think that it does make a nice change. Do you have two words?
Well, I'm just going to say fraudulent illusion. Don't know what that means, really.
No,
I'll just stick with that.
No, we make that stuff up all the time on this show. My two are old fashioned, and I mean that in a good way.
a slow week for news, we lead with the Weinstein Company.
Slow is not even the word, best word. Sheesh.
Doubling down. The Weinstein Company are doubling down on Salinger by...
There was a power cut in Batoni on Friday night.
Yes, yeah. Yes, there was. Mm. Couldn't play Grand Theft Auto 5.
Do you get to claim on your insurance when that happens, or do you just eat it?
Just suck it up.
Yeah.
It was only open for 30 minutes.
Okay.
It's okay. But right before the power was cut, I pulled the matches out of the drawer and put the emergency candles on the counter. I'm like, I think the power's going to go.
Nice work.
Yeah, you want me to be there.
That's that practical Canadian-ness of you there. On my way into Petone this afternoon, there was warnings of flooding.
Really?
Yeah, yep. That people were being told to move their cars out of the Riverside car park.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, that's pretty common.
You know, anyway. That's how we roll in the hut.
That's right.
The Weinstein Company are doubling down on Salinger by announcing a fictional feature film based on the life of the reclusive author. The script will be written by the writer-director of the recent documentary, Shane Salerno.
See, I just think that's the most pointless idea that I've heard in a long, long time. Nobody is going to see the documentary. Nobody cares.
Nobody knows it's there.
Nobody knows it's there. I suppose that the big announcement that came out of the documentary was that his unpublished work was going to start to emerge in 2015, and that it'll be about the time that a feature film would be ready. So I imagine that there's probably even more to cash in there, but still pretty lame idea. Hollywood, think again.
But it is a very American thing, I guess.
Yeah.
Just don't think you should release it here.
could say that about a few things.
Jerry Bruckheimer has lost his first look deal with Disney after nearly 20 years. He's now free to shop his big budget extravaganzas around any studio with the checkbooks big enough to handle the likes of Prince of Persia, G-Force, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and of course, The Lone Ranger.
He has lost Disney so much money. I mean, he made them heaps of money with Pirates of the Caribbean, obviously. So I imagine the deal's still in profit somewhere along the line. But yeah, there's been a lot of money spent on Bruckheimer movies there.
He's probably still getting the money through Survivor Series, because ABC is owned by Disney. So he's got television still making
the
money.
Is that a Bruckheimer?
That's a Bruckheimer. Boy, I think so.
One of those?
The Survivor television series that's been running for years. I'm pretty sure it is.
In which half naked people get voted off islands.
Oh,
is that basically
right.
So
skinny models and stuff who can set challenges of eating things and getting to a boat or something.
Yeah. I mean,
it's pretty high drama stuff.
I've heard of it. Never actually watched
of
one.
Television.
And that is anybody got any?
So we've got Bruckheimer to thank for those things.
Yeah, we got Bruckheimer to thank for quite a lot, actually.
And Mark Croft, he's the other one responsible.
Him and Simon, yeah, not our Mark Croft. Him and Simon Cowell, between the two of them, are probably the most negative forces in the world.
I saw something with Simon Cowell the other day. That's all I'll say about that.
Did you switch the channel immediately?
No, a movie. Oh.
A movie with Simon Cowell in it.
Oh, that one. Oh,
I was going to say, so you did go to see One Direction after all that.
No.
Anyway, anything else news-wise? Because I couldn't think of any. It was pretty quiet. Because all the entertainment news was about the Emmys, which is, of course, television, which we don't talk about.
Yeah.
Except for Candelabra getting... You could probably
I suppose so, yeah. Candelabra picked up...
And what a bizarre release pattern, eh?
For Candelabra?
Yeah. Mm.
To what? To go...
TV, then theatrical.
Yeah, I think that... It's sort of bizarre, but also sort of the way of the future, I suspect. You know, as long as HBO and Netflix are going to keep putting their money into these things.
I don't think they knew what they had. And I also think, you know, what a punt to take given the actors involved that you make that for TV.
It didn't screen in US theatrically?
No.
Okay.
Straight to
I didn't
TV.
Think so.
No.
I read an article today about Behind the Candelabra saying, and this may be hearsay, but saying it was too gay for theatrical release in the US.
They couldn't get it funded, Si. This is the thing, is that they were shopping that script around for years, and only
ridiculous.
HBO would write the check.
There's hardly anything of offence in there.
But this is America. I know what you're talking about.
You can't cope with that. I mean, you can't go to the beach.
Well,
it's a little bit different on a public beach.
Yeah, I don't know about the beaches
I'm just saying,
you go to.
In terms of people's bodies and stuff and skin.
No. There are sex scenes in it. There's two sex scenes.
And
in
Matt Damon. Not sexy Matt Damon.
But they're not sex scenes that are... Sorry, I'm... Get my
You're obsessed, aren't you?
They're not sex scenes that are kind of graphic in any way.
No.
It's just a bit of rolling around under a sheet. I mean, that's... It's not...
Well, yeah. Some people aren't that open-minded and they do take offence to those images.
Well, poo-poo on them. That's what I say.
That's what I think, too. Yeah.
Well, what I would suggest is that perhaps the success the success of Candelabra might change things in the future. You know, who knows whether those subjects might be slightly more... the studios... Because that's really where the who said no. I'm sure he might have been able to get some independent funding, but then the budget would have been so much smaller.
Because you can't tell me that smaller indie films don't play in America, which are, you know, I mean, there's probably gay film festivals and all sorts going on. I mean, yeah, it just seems ridiculous that a film like that couldn't play theatrically in the US.
Yeah,
well, it's to do with the funding, and that's all.
Yeah, it is, and it's studio conservatism, and it's the fact that studios have stockholders, and they've all, you know, they have to have their annual general meetings, and this is capitalism, Simon. You're normal. In favour of it.
And HBO has a lot of money.
I'm a welfare state man, my friend.
HBO has a lot of money.
It does. Yeah. And it also has a lot of money, and it doesn't have the same commercial drivers that the studios have, you know. As we know from the sort of stuff it's choosing to make for television, it can be a lot braver because it can take more punts and take bigger ones. So, and Netflix is doing the same thing with a lot of their television content as well, because they just don't have to. They don't have to have. They don't have to measure eyeballs in quite the same way that everybody else does. And so, you know, you can take longer to get your return back on those things.
Yeah, but you've got to create awareness. There's no point releasing a lot of content. You know, a huge amount of content needs that theatrical window to get that profile up. You know, otherwise. Trying to release something through other sort of formats or channels is very hard. You know, people have got to find it, they've got to know what it's about, they've got to sort of have confidence to watch it, give away 2 hours of their life, you know, night, their evening, whatever. I think it's this whole sort of internet. Utopia of the sort of liberal world of you know, everything being there for everyone when they want it, it's, you know, and as cheaply as they can get it and blah blah blah. It's kind of nice, but it's naive. You still need to have windows of titles being released so that they can then maximize the results on those windows, for that content. And it seems to me that why would you like from a Candelabra, why would you take that window out? Why not have that window, increase the profile, and then smack it on TV and do it again? You know, it just seems strange to me.
I would say that the argument would be, HBO's argument would be that they've got a customer base.
Yeah, but they could have a bigger one, and they could, if they own that film. I mean, HBO can release it theatrically, can't they?
No, because what will happen is that what is the advantage to being an HBO subscriber if other people are getting to watch it first theatrically?
Because you don't know what it is.
The whole point about HBO.
But you don't know what it is.
But you've already paid for your HBO subscription. So
where's the media? Where's the reviews? Where's all the?
It went to Cannes. It won at Cannes.
But it's still harder to me. It's a lot harder to release something like either via the internet or through TV.
I think
without having. I mean, look at shows like that New Zealand thing, you know, Under the Lake or whatever it was. You know, I mean, compared to, I mean, that, I'm sure it's not one of their strong performers. Because the profile isn't there, people don't know what it is, and I scroll through Soho and I'll go, I don't know what that is. Okay, I know what that is. I'll watch it, or you know, it's Breaking Bad. Okay, I know a lot about that. It's got all this huge amount of press and history, and I'll watch that because that's how people kind of do it. And it's the same way. It's the same process with film. You've got to know what it is, and you've got to have the media behind it in a way.
Yeah, I think I can't speak for HBO, obviously, but I would say that that first of all, you have the ability to trail your product direct to your subscribers, so you can completely control what they see and what they get excited about. So you can have 6 weeks of ads about Beyond the Candelabra playing. People know that it's Michael Douglas. They know that it's Liberace. They know that it's Matt Damon, and they've got 6 weeks to get it excited about it, and it's going to play on a Sunday night, and it becomes like old fashioned appointment television.
True, but I think they missed a little earlier.
You think they left some money on the table?
I think they did.
I think that their argument would be that they would have lost more money from their actual customer base. But anyway, we're talking about television, which we're not supposed to talk about on this
show.
But maybe we should have a special. We should get a few, because I know a lot of people have opinions about this particular subject on Windows, on video on demand, and on the different ways that films are getting in front of people. And, you know, I don't know if anybody's got the answers. Everybody, there's lots of experiments. There's lots of people trying stuff.
The answer's simple. If you own a product, you have the right to release it how you like. If you own something, who are you to? Why should you be forced into releasing it immediately? Or you release it when you think you can maximize the return, and through whatever windows you like, because you own it.
I don't disagree with that, but
once people
we all know customers.
Yeah, but
that'll just go stuff you. I'm gonna.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, they're not bankrolling these things.
No, evidently not. They're not even paying for it in most cases.
Well, in a lot of cases. But if you own something, surely it's no different than PlayStation saying we're going to release this product before Christmas because we can. That's when everyone's going to buy it. We're not going to release it 3 or 4 months before that. What's the difference? You know,
yeah,
if you're an owner of that content.
Look, you're not going to get much argument from me on this particular one because I do agree with that. And I also understand that not only is this about individual owners of content, this is about multiple owners of content in different territories, which complicates things even further. Time is moving, marching on. And I just want to introduce, you can pound your stress astronaut. There, he's getting very wound up, ladies and gentlemen. This is woken Simon up, this discussion. Anyway, tonight in Auckland, this is Wednesday night for those of you listening tonight. Anyway, hard to know when you're listening, but anyway, on Wednesday night in Auckland, it's the gala opening of the 18th Italian Film Festival. And yesterday I spoke to Tony Lambert, who's the director of the festival, about the history behind it and some of the titles that he's bringing to New Zealand audiences. Joining me on the line from Auckland is Tony Lambert, who's the director of the Italian Film Festival this year, 2013. It's the 18th Italian Film Festival around the country. Tony, welcome to Cinematica.
Buongiorno.
It's lovely to have you on the show. Tony, you have been involved in the Italian Film Festival in New Zealand for many, many years. We were just talking off air about how long it is that our annual sort of contact has been going on for. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved and where the festival sprang from.
The festival, as you said, started 18 years ago. This is my 13th year. The festival started by a Roman woman, an Italian from Rome, who was bored and also a film Italian, well, a nut, film nut, of course, Italian film.
Yeah.
And so she decided to do it for something to do. Unfortunately, she was not a commercially focused person and ran it as purely, put some films on and hopefully people will come. So that nearly ran out of steam by the time I came on board. And long story, and I'm not going to tell you of how I got involved, but it was from 1 minute to the next decision, which has then evolved into 13 years involvement in the festival and a lot of Italian-related things. And I've got this little analogy that if you're driving along and all of a sudden you come to a right-hand bend, a left or right intersection, you can either go straight on in your life or you can actually take that absolutely, perpendicular road. And it's happened to me in my life 3 times, and the Italian Film Festival was the third, and in some ways I actually hope the last, because it's quite a big shift in your life to go from doing something to doing something completely different. But it's been fantastic, and I mentioned this recently in a speech I gave, that I am so lucky, and I use that word very carefully, because it has a big component of luck in it to become involved in the festival, because what has happened is I've met an enormous amount of people I would never have even passed on the street, and that has been great. That has been absolutely fantastic. I have a number of other Italian businesses that I'm now involved in.
I was going to ask you, 13 years ago when you got involved, were you a film buff yourself? Were you looking to get into the film business?
No. And quite frankly, I'd still say I'm not. You see, my background's in computing, but over the last 15 years before I took over the film festival, it was in marketing. And so I was marketing and sales director for Compaq Computer in New Zealand. So that's where my expertise is. I know I'm good at both selling things, but also providing a package for a customer, which is sort of marketing related, that somebody wants. And the film festival really is another product, you know, an avenue of getting a product to the customers, which of course in this case are called audience. And the product is actually film screening in a cinema. But it's really packaging that up and giving people an opportunity in the best possible way to be able to see those films and also telling them why they're so good in the first place. And I think that's why, and I'm sort of blowing my own trumpet a bit, that's why the Italian Film Festival is more successful than all the other cultural ones, because the way we package it and the way it's sold and the way that it's consistent. Really consistent.
Yeah, I was going to say consistency is absolutely key. That you know as an audience member that the program's going to be thorough. It's going to be large. You know, there's a generous selection of films every year, and also that you know that the quality of those films is going to be of a uniform standard.
Absolutely, and that's important for the audience. And I do. I even get people email me before I make any announcement, saying, you know, when is the festival? I need to put it in my diary. And I'm pleased to be able to say nowadays that's easy. Just put in the same dates you did last year and take away a day. So that's basically what we do every single year, and that's my plan to make it easy for people to come. But it makes it easy for me too, because it's easier. Every year is easier to do because it's quite frankly really just turning a handle in terms of the administration of getting the festival done. The hard part is still choosing which films to screen. That in the first 4, 5, 6 years for me was virtually impossible. And I used some people to give me guidance and made some mistakes. But nowadays I really have a good idea of what's going to be popular and what's not. I mean, I know in the festival this year there are films that very few people will come to, but I think they're worth screening because they are good, but the New Zealand audience is very much focused on romantic comedies, so the more of those I have, the better financially, but we don't want to overdo it. But then again, I'm never going to be able to overdo it because there's never enough.
Indeed, and the Italian film industry as such is still a huge thing. Like the strength of Italian films domestically in Italy is still it's still a really big deal, isn't it? They make a lot of films and they watch a lot of films.
Yeah, it is unfortunately somewhat of a shadow compared to what it used to be because of the financial situation in Italy. The Italian economic environment is poor. But that's not new. And therefore, the decisions that are made in the film industry, because there is a smaller pot, tend to be more political. So the lower the amount of number of money, the higher the political component of a decision is made. So you'll find that people are given funds by the government that are people that would be of assistance to the government, or it's what the government wants the message to be, or whatever. And Berlusconi, though he's not in power, made a comment a number of years back saying, oh, I want more and more dubbed films made because I want the Americans to watch more Italian films. And everybody put up their hands in horror and went, oh, for God's sake, don't do that. But that was his idea, and therefore that's what the industry was told to do. Thank God he was kicked out another time, not long after that, and so that never actually came to fruition. But, you know, the choice of senior positions is very political in all of the funding organizations in Italy, and therefore, you know, that they make films that are based on what the senior people in the Italian community want. And so that does make a difference, and it has hurt the Italian industry. On the other side, there are a whole bunch of independents now making films, a whole bunch of them. It's, in that perspective, very much like New Zealand. Lots of little companies making good films, and those are the films that I really, really enjoy. Those little, what I call little films, that don't have either big cast or big scenery or big, you know, big story. They're just very intimate. And those are the ones that are really great to watch.
What's an example of one of those in the program for this year that people could look out for?
Well, Shun Lian Poet, which we saw at the media preview, I would class as that, made by an ex-documentary filmmaker. And so that style of filmmaking comes to the fore in the long, lingering, you know, vistas that he puts into the film, which are just fantastic, of Venice in winter. And the intimate relationship and, the intimate relationship between the people, but also the very close-ups that he has of people during the filmmaking. And, you know, I call that a nice, intimate, small film, but, wow, it's very powerful.
It also shines a little bit of a light on aspects of Italian society and culture that are not normally seen on screen. The role of the immigrant or the new Italian, of which Shun Lian and the poet are both immigrants, aren't they? You know, Shun Lian, a Chinese arrival, sort of indentured immigrant, sort of stuck, having to pay off her debts to her Chinese supporters, and the poet, played by Rada Sabeggia, maybe this is just an excuse for his the accent of his Italian, but they make a point of him being
He's a fisherman. He does come from the ex-Yugoslavia.
Yeah,
they make that right at the beginning. They talk very, very briefly about that, or intimate that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's sort of two outsiders a very homogenous, or at least a homogenous society that would like to see itself as homogenous, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Played inside a cafe most of the time, or in sweatshops that the Chinese have stuck their countrymen while they pay off their debt. And there's a number of films in the festival along those lines. Islands, it's all about a Romanian who every day comes to an Italian island to work, to make some money, and goes back every day to Romania. I mean, what a life. Terra Firma, all about Africans trying to swim across the ocean to Italy, but catch these fishing boats and the issues of one sinking and people being rescued. I mean, it reminds me of Australia and their issues. But, you know, the immigration is such a huge issue in Italy. And until you go and get, and even in the touristed area in Italy, you do see a lot of African selling stuff. But until you get out into the suburbs, you don't realize that they're actually... And it's a crazy number. There are 5 million illegal immigrants in Italy. And that is that's as many as New Zealanders. You know, there's 5 million of them. And that's just because borders are so porous. And they're just people just come and go. Illegal, I do count all of the Eastern Europeans and all that, the Bulgarians, Romanians, Africans, and the whole of Africa, all the way down to the bottom. You know, they come all the way through Africa. To go across that 100 kilometres or even less,
and once you're, and of course the nature of Europe, once you're in Italy, you're in.
Yep.
Go anywhere you like, pretty much.
And then you get supported by every man and his dog, and that's what's driving as well. Another issue is a huge mafia control of Italy, which is growing daily because they've got this massive labour force that they just dive into.
Yeah, and a labour force that they can control. Yes, yeah.
There's some horrible stories, you know, that where they do live, they put them in camps. This is a quasi-government, basically. So anyway, but
yes, I was going to say this. Maybe on a lighter note, we could have a look at some of your comedies. And if there's one thing that Italian cinema is known for, it's probably sex, actually, and a sort of enlightened, rigorous attitude to sex on screen. And you sent me a preview of a film called Love Is in the Air, which is just
and
nuts.
I'm so disappointed I haven't got that in 3D, because there's a 3D version of it, and it is absolutely hilarious. You have little dildos jumping through the screen at you at the beginning during the credits, I watched it right, and I sat right at the front. And if you do go to 3D, for God's sake, sit near the front of the screen. It's so much more fun. But I was sitting next to the sales agent. This was in Cannes when I was watching it, and he hadn't even seen it. And so I was sitting next to him, and this comes on, and we both go, "Oh my God!" But unfortunately, I haven't got it. But it's a very, very light film, but it's really good fun. It's got so much colour in it. I mean, it's even got dancing and singing, and it's got absolute craziness. But that's the difference of Italian romantic comedies. Most of them, and I'm saying all of them, but most of them have actually got craziness in them. And that's what's so outright laughingly hilarious, is that you sit there and you go, "Oh my God, that's mad. It's absolutely crazy, but it's so funny." And that's why everybody loves them, because they're just going, it's a lovely escapism. You sit there and you just look at this and you go, "Wow, that's just nuts."
I remember a film that you brought in the early days of my involvement with the Italian Film Festival, which was called Three Men and a Leg.
Oh, Three Men and a Leg. That's the
which was just the most hysterical. I don't think I've ever laughed as much as in a cinema as I have with that particular film. And yet, if I tried to explain it even to myself, it would not be what I would normally go for. I would go,
How did they get in a slapstick? Because that was pure slapstick most of the time. In fact, down to even slapping each other, you know, that sort of old style. They even drew in a girl who falls in love with one of the three guys, three men. And they drew it in, and it worked beautifully. So you have this romance in amongst the slapstick, which would never happen in any other culture's filmmaking, and it works beautifully.
Just one more that I'd like to mention is a sequel to a hugely successful film, which it was in itself a remake of a hugely successful French movie, Welcome to the South. We now have Welcome to the North.
I saw the French version, Welcome to the Sticks, and no way I'm going to try and say the French name for it, because it's, as far as I'm concerned, unpronounceable. Welcome to the Sticks in France was really good. French was really good. Welcome to the South, Italian version, I thought was actually better, and I'm not being biased. I did actually think it was better. But they had to, and I was very surprised when the French didn't make a follow-up. And the Italians very cleverly did make a follow-up, because it fits perfectly. I mean, in the Welcome to the South, of course, the person goes south with his enormous amount of prejudices, and leaves behind his family who send him off with flak jacket and, you know, a beacon to, you know, all this stuff, batteries because there's no power in the south, and food, and you name it. And the people in the north, south, are just scared to hell about this guy coming, because, of course, he's going to bring all of his prejudices that they believe in with him, sorry, his stereotypes with him. And, of course, I don't give anything away about Welcome to the South. They fall in love with each other, everybody. They just think they're all both wonderful. So, of course, now we're going back to the north, and, of course, we have exactly the same again, except the same characters. So they know each other, but the people coming from the south are thinking, "Oh my God, what am I getting myself into?" Because the North, of course, is portrayed as this grey, amorphous mass of cold and terrible food and
industrial
and
sort of
people.
Yeah.
And so the people from the South come to visit, and I won't give away the reason why. And well, you have all sorts of hilarity comes out of that.
Tony, you take the Italian Film Festival about as wide around New Zealand as it's possible to go. You get underway tomorrow. Actually, we're going to be editing this into the show on Wednesday. So today, actually, in Auckland. Where else are you taking the festival? It takes up a large amount of your time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it the festival actually runs over about a two-month period. In fact, just over 2 months now, because Hamilton has extended now to 3 weeks. So Hamilton ends it, Auckland opens it, Wellington follows Auckland 2 weeks today.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we will be in Christchurch. That's another long story.
Keeping
my fingers crossed that Hollywood remains open. Then Rialto Dunedin. Then so we've gone down the country. That's every week on a Wednesday we open. And I visit every single city for every single opening. And then we come up via Nelson. We're then going to Tauranga this year, then Hawke's Bay, and finish up in Hamilton. And Hamilton ends on, I think, the 4th of December.
Goodness me. I have to say that the Italian Film Festival is probably the jolliest film festival of the year. Yeah, it's one I always look forward to. And certainly, did all the other centres get the same quality of catering at the gala as Wellington? Because, it's something else down here.
Yeah, well, Nicolini's is a standout, and that's because the guys can't help themselves, particularly Fab in the kitchen. All of us, including his brothers, keep saying, come on, Fab, don't get so carried away. That is fantastic. You can end up with a platter of food per person if you're not careful. Yes, it is, and the reason is because in nearly all centres, I have an association with an Italian restaurant, or basically an Italian person, forget about the restaurant, I've got a relationship with the person, and they all want to showcase both the restaurant and themselves, but also they want to see, because a lot of Italians are invited to the opening nights in each location, so they want to show everybody, this is my restaurant, don't forget about us. So. And it is, it's great.
Fantastic.
And that's what the thing's about, it's all about community and family.
It is. Tony Lambert from the Italian Film Festival, thanks very much for being on Cinematica.
Oh, pleasure.
Bonjour. J'ai le sentiment que toute ma vie dépend de cet instant précis.
C'est un peu court, hein?
So, following on from that discussion we just had, actually, Mood Indigo, Michel Gondry's film, would be an example of something that the release of which in New Zealand appears to have been mishandled, shall we say, because it's not found an audience on opening weekend. It's very hard to find anything out about it. Like, I went hunting for a few hours this morning looking for clips or anything about the film that I could use for audio for the show, and there's one trailer, and that trailer has two lines of dialogue in it, and it just seems to me that this is a film that perhaps could have benefited from either more weight behind it or a delay until it had some momentum internationally. So you know how, New York Times and all that sort of stuff, sometimes these things create the sort of attention that Simon was talking about just beforehand. And to add to the confusion, of course, there are two versions of this film now. There's the original version, which screened during the film festival, and then there's the theatrical version, which is about half an hour shorter. This is going to be the first time, I think, that Kaylee and I have reviewed a film together, and we're actually going to be reviewing two different films, because you've seen the original version. Mm-hmm. I saw the theatrical cut this afternoon. Neither of us have seen the other version.
No.
So
it's going to be hard.
It's confusing, right? So do you want to start with what you loved about the theatrical version, and I'll see if that rings true.
The festival version. Yes. I love Michel Gondry and his arts and crafts cut and paste aesthetic. I like how his frames, it's all this sort of clunky is the wrong word, but sort of like funny stop motion.
Handmade,
and there's a lot of that, like, really great sort of old school Michel Gondry going on in this film.
Clever rear projection, and not just projection, but actually just like having people behind a screen
yeah, just lots of visual cleverness. Too clever by half.
Yeah, and a lot of visual puns as well, which are quite funny. I didn't quite catch them all, but it's a French thing, I guess. So I went into it. I really liked Michel Gondry's work. I knew what to expect. Although I was sitting too close to the screen. So I do suggest sitting a bit far back because there is a lot going on, especially at the beginning. There's a lot of things moving around the frame and there's lots of things to look
and
at.
And some of the shots are actually really short, it seemed to me. And so it's short and frenetic.
Like, yeah, there's a lot going on.
And I found it quite hard to actually register all of the detail that was going on inside, you know, which seemed a shame considering how much effort would have gone into every shot.
So yeah, I saw the festival version, which runs at 130 minutes. It did feel a little bit long, but again, I love being in his like storytelling world. It's based on a book, so it isn't his usual sort of a little bit sad but uplifting fare. It gets quite dark, and I really like the way that the film transitions from being bright and colorful and wonderful when they first meet and fall in love to this, you know, the sad turn of events, and we end up at the end of the film being basically in black and white and sort of, you know, the hard truth of life.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed it.
It's a love, lost love story, isn't it? And
which he does so well.
Yeah, it's powerfully effective, the romance of it. Audrey Tautou, Romain Duris, and with a fantastic supporting cast, including Omar Sy from Untouchables. The camera loves him just as much as it always has done. There's a real French word here, joie de vivre, about the falling in love part, and then they get to the wedding, and then it's sort of downhill from then on. We won't sort of give away quite how that happens, but it's pretty moving stuff, isn't it?
It's quite grim. Yeah,
but my version, the version that I saw, it seemed that second half of the film, the downward stretch, happened almost too quick to be comfortable, too quick for me to fully register the emotion behind it all. Almost as if, and I'm perhaps guessing at the intentions of the people who recut it here, that the downer of it, they wanted to get over and done with as fast as possible, so that basically your memory of the film will be of the whimsy rather than the full sort of breadth of the story. Now, I'm guessing that that's the case. I don't know if I'm going to have a chance to watch the longer version now. Maybe at some point there'll be a proper director's cut version to watch at home, but
you may have to order the Blu-ray from France.
Maybe.
Was there a bit of tension between the makers of the film and this cut, or was this just something that was decided?
It's a Gondry approved cut,
right?
So, but who knows what pressure he was put under? And is this another Weinstein decision? Is this what the Weinsteins butchering another film to get an extra session in a day?
I'm not sure. I know that that name was bandied around in the information that I was reading, but I thought it was just referencing the fact that the Weinsteins tend to cut films without telling the director.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know the answer to that, but it does seem that a little unfair on an extraordinary amount of visual imagination. That it isn't given the full weight. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, the theatrical version is the only one that there is to go and see. Should you go? My answer would be yes, probably. If you're interested in seeing something that, you know, we complain so much in this world about, you know, everything's boring, it's the same, and we've seen it before, and, you know, we're watching the same old stories told the same old way, and, you know, 8 films released last week, and crikey, 7 out of 8 of them would have been basically the same, you know. And when something like this comes along, even flawed though it is, it's a real pleasure to see so much care and attention put into every single frame of that film. And, you know, sometimes it felt too much. Sometimes it felt like there was too much to take in, too much to keep track of. But, you know, when somebody goes to that sort of effort, you know, you should reward them with your attention, I think.
Yeah, so hopefully that we will see the festival version as a director's cut come out. Fingers crossed it happens.
Yeah, sure.
But definitely go see it, I think. Especially if you're a fan of Gondry's work, because it is very beautifully done.
Okay, so two words.
I think my two words for Moody and the Go would be strange pleasure.
Right, and mine will be handmade for Mood Indigo. So that is our show for this week. Next week it's the Big School Holiday Roundup, Turbo, Planes, Percy Jackson, The Smurfs, One Direction, plus highlights from our Q&A with Mr. Pip author Lloyd Jones, which is on Monday night at the Lighthouse Cinema in Cuba Street. You can go to the Lighthouse Cinema website to book for that. It's not the biggest theatre in the world, so seating is limited for that. You get to see Mr. Pip 3 days before it opens to the public, and you'll get to ask the author of the novel.
Oh, yeah, that's, yeah.
Roughly.
Nope, I don't know what day it is, never mind. Yes.
You'll get to ask questions of the author of the novel, Lloyd Jones. So, very special occasion. So, we'll have the best of that on the show as well.
Unfortunately, Hugh Laurie didn't return our phone calls.
Heard this jazz sort of recording with a voice message.
He's singing the blues. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software. And I have to say, the latest updates to iTunes with regard to podcasting quite a few steps backwards in functionality, so I'm looking for some new podcasting software to manage all of my listening. It's been very awkward wrangling all of that stuff. Anyway, the latest episode will always be downloaded automatically if you choose the right software. Please leave us feedback at the iTunes store. Ratings, reviews, etc., they're all super useful to help more people discover the show. You can contact us with two-word reviews, feedback like, you know, faster.
Yeah.
Faster.
Louder and funnier.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. You can find us on Twitter via @CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, where you can read our two-word reviews, and as always on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
All right. The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6. Well, it wasn't this week, actually, by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy it at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with more music. This is Duke Ellington's Chloé from Mood Indigo, recorded in 1940. Until next week, that's all from me.
And me.
And me.